You guys, guess what? This
what?
Is a big day. Like, this is the biggest.
It's not your birthday.
No. No, you might think so. It's not. Black Friday? No. No. Cyber Monday? No. The Super Bowl? No. It's not even the anniversary of the first time I saw Pride and Prejudice.
Oh my word.
It is my local Friends of the Library book sale.
Oh!
And I want you to know, I plan for this. I take my rolling cart. I've got my cash. I am ready!
Welcome to Book Fair. We help thoughtful women find wholesome, life-affirming books for themselves and their families.
Are you tired of picking up the latest new release and finding it full of junk you don't want in your life? You are in the right place.
This show shares curated content, and we do it together within a fun, book-loving community. So pull up a chair at the table and join the feast.
Okay, well, welcome, listeners, to another Book Fair Book Club episode. Today's book, Everything Sad is Untrue by Daniel Neary. And listeners, we have a private Facebook group. And in there, you can vote on our book club picks. And you guys never fail. This was such a great pick. I'm so glad y'all voted this in. This has been on my TBR for the year. I've never read this before. And I am so glad I read this book. So I bet our conversation will be a bit structured like the book.
Little jump all over the place.
Yes. Discussion points will weave in and out of our conversation. We'll jump back and forth in time. It'll be great.
And you didn't know it was all relevant to this conversation.
I know. So I would just first love to hear, because I think, Trisha, this was your second time reading it, and Elizabeth, this was your first time, like
first.
Me. So I would just love to hear just your general thoughts, just to kick us off here. What did you think? Did you like it? Why not? What are your overall impressions and thoughts about it?
I love this book. It started getting some buzz in the circles that, you know, I hear about last year. And so I got it from the library and read, you know, a paper book. It was like in my before bed reading. So I read it over, you know, the course of a couple of weeks, and I loved it. Loved all of the stories, loved his journey, loved the way it weaves in culture, faith, family, humor, like
food,
so much food
and poop.
It had me wishing that I'd known about this book when my kids were like 11 and 14, that this could have been a read aloud for us. Because, you know, boys love the poop stories. Like, this would have kept them totally engaged and amused. So I completely loved it. And then this time I was already in the middle of paper books. And so I got the audiobook and I listened to it and read by the author. He does such a great job. You guys, sometimes whenever I see a book is read by the author, I get a little bit anxious because some authors should not be narrators.
Aww.
And I am not one of these people who just thinks because it's the author. Like, I think some people, and this is fine if this is you, but some people can just overlook whether they're really a, quote, a good reader, like whether they can have good inflection or a good timbre in their voice, because they just love the fact that this is their work. So they just love the idea that I'm hearing the voice of the person who wrote it.
Yeah, I do kind of feel that way, but I also get what you're saying.
No, I am not one of those people. We're going to be having a whole episode on Brené Brown, and Brené, I love you. You should not read your own work. You should not.
Hot take. So fair hot takes.
But Daniel Neary, well done.
Yeah.
Well done. His voice is great. He's has great expression and inflection, and hearing it from him when you know it's his story and how, you know, it's semi-autobiographical. Loved hearing him tell it. Loved it. Loved it. Loved it. Loved it. So Elizabeth, what did you think?
Man, I loved it so much. I know that some people discuss the jumping around, but I am a mom of boys, and it is exactly how a 10-year-old boy would tell you a story. It is exactly the jumping around and the squirrel, but it wasn't a squirrel. It really mattered. And it, the connection for a child is different than the connections for an adult. And to have a child who just knows too much about the world, sadly. My children do not know that kind of thing. They know history, but they don't know their history with that much pain in it. And to have it so black and white, as only a child can be that black and white, was like a beautiful way to tell this story. This story could have been told differently, but his voice as a child, in the way that a kid would say, oh, I'm sorry, it doesn't matter, you don't have to say my name. Oh, that was a punch in the gut. So I loved it. I love the jumping around because it is just me cooking dinner, listening to my little boy tell me some crazy story. And then me go, oh, wait a minute. This is really important to them. I need to really listen.
Yeah. The way he wove that to where it does feel like a child telling it. But then to me, you get about a third of the way and you're like,
and it's, oh, it's real.
But this is masterfully woven.
Yes.
Like he is doing it in the voice of a child, but he is masterfully weaving a story. And then you get to the end and it just all comes together and you're like, this man is a genius. Oh my word.
Mm-hmm. And at the same time that he is weaving, I love how he will even just take a cultural reference like sleeping bags or BBQ, and you hear
explain
it come
them.
Back. Yeah, he explains it, which
fruit
is fantastic.
It is fruit leather that is not fruit leather.
So true. And they come back around in a different context as further explanation for something that's going on. It is so smart. Like there's a BBQ thread through the book. So it's like thread talking about weaving. And on another level of this story, he talks about literal weaving and the Persian rugs and the mistake, the flaws that they purposefully embed and what that means. And that our lives are like that. So there is so many levels. And I just was astounded by that. The patchwork, the threads, all of those words keep coming back up.
Yeah.
That this can blow, that this is a great example of what Lewis talks about, that a children's book is not a good book if the adult also is not engaged by it.
Yeah.
Super paraphrased, obviously, but because my mind is blown by all these levels, but yet, you know, I've been telling Ben, he's got to read this. I was quoting to him some of the poop and food stuff, and he was like, yes, I love this. He was laughing so hard. And I was like, Bryce, you need to put this on hold. Put this audiobook on hold. You've got to listen to this book. It's so good. So it's on hold. It's in line.
Oh, I can't wait to hear what he says.
So, I'll jump in and ask you this question. So, Amanda, tell us what age your kids are right now.
Okay, my boys are 14 and 12.
So, at what age would you read this out loud with your family?
Ruby is 9. I would have to think about that for her.
Yeah.
I agree. I wouldn't yet for Nate either.
Yeah. Just off the top of my head, I'd be very hesitant to do that with her. Yep. And I'm a little hesitant even for Josiah. He's my 12-year-old. You know, some kids are a little more sensitive than others towards what other people go through.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's one reason I might hesitate for him, even though he's 12. but also he is the king of potty humor right now. Why give him more ammunition? You know?
Come on.
I'm kidding, but
give him the literary poop story.
I know. I would say trading their affections. This is a good poop story. This is poop story you should love.
With virtue. Poop story with virtue. Right. And honor.
Right, right.
No. I would definitely say 12, 14. I mean, I don't currently have a 12 or 14, but I would have read this with Trenton around that age. And I can, you know, if I'm projecting Nate, of, you know, where I think he'll be then, I would definitely read it around that age with him. Because I do, now y'all know I'm a four though. So like if it's really, if they're feeling good and sensitive about it, I'm like, good, you're supposed to. But I don't want to be wrecked for like can't sleep at night. But also I do think stories that keep us up at night are doing their job. So
yeah, I think if I can think of a way to do a read aloud with just the boys, I think I would absolutely read it aloud with Josiah too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can just picture the you and Ben and the two boys just like cackling.
Yes,
reading
yes.
this book.
Yes,
and also minor, you know, spoiler alert for The Island of Sea Women. I have not read that book for 2 years, but there is also a poop thread in that book.
Yes.
Much more like subtle and adult.
Oh, I've Googled all about that.
But super interesting, right?
Yes.
So
yes.
I just think it is kind of true what he says about those are the things that
the true
all humans have, you know?
What you eat and where you poop. Isn't yeah. that it? Yes.
I was totally on board with the poop discussions. I loved what he was saying underneath that about health and our food, about yes. what we're doing to our bodies, and about yes. like what y'all just said, the socioeconomic implications of what
poor
you eat and where you
kid had
poop.
never had a sloppy Joe and it just was not okay for him. I was like in tears for him. Like how embarrassed he must have been. But also like, I love that he had the integrity of like, you people are kind of gross. Like I'm being polite here. Y'all are the weirdos. You do this toilet paper thing. You eat this weird food that makes your body do awful things. Like I loved his integrity in that. I'm still going to stand on your dumb toilet.
Yeah, he's like, you guys think
it's a terrible idea.
We're the uncivilized, but we have better food, better guts, better poop, and you go on a hemorrhoid throne, and ours weighs better. So,
really, really funny, but also really saying a real message.
Yeah.
Also, like, we did a whole episode on reading outside of your culture, and we've talked about how that is such a great tool for empathy, for creating empathy for people from other perspectives, you know, understanding people who live different lives, cultural differences, perspective differences, all of that. I think this might be the best book I've ever read at opening my eyes to how to have true hospitality for someone.
Yes.
How to be aware of what it might be like for someone else to come into our culture, whether that's someone from another country, whether that's just someone from another faith, someone from, you know, another background, that things like mm-hmm. that seem so basic, like going to the bathroom or the food that you eat, that like this poor little boy just needed someone to like ask him questions and make sure he was okay. And everyone just assumed he just knew everything and that he was like they were. And
or a liar. I feel like all the kids always were like, whatever,
like, of course,
that's so dumb.
I mean, yeah, that's the worst. But like, that's another reason. Like, I think I so wanted to rewind time and revisit this with my kids because I just think it would be such a great
and important.
Important read for kids to help them see what it would be like for another kid coming to your culture. I just, it's worth reading for that alone.
That's a great point.
We thrive on sameness. I mean, that's just mankind. We're tribal. We start to group together in sameness. But as much as we as adults know to fight against that, children all the more. You know, you have the same color hair as me and you like Pokemon, we're best friends. And so what happens when someone comes in who has never heard of Pokemon? I mean, this was the 90s, so it wouldn't have been Pokemon maybe then, but whatever, that sameness is not there in any kind of recognizable way. Can you see them as a person? Can we teach our children that as a person too? And you need to get to know them. It's going to be good. It's going to be so good.
And again, going back to the levels, talking about hospitality, I hadn't applied that word to this, but I think that's so appropriate. And he shows hospitality to all the cultures he has experienced in that book. This was not a guilt trip book. He's not condemning any cultures. There were good parts of every culture he went through.
Yep.
And there were also mean people in every place he was in. And there were some good people. So I really appreciate it. Just had a thing come up on my computer. Get out of here, Adobe. Stop interrupting my life. Anyway.
This episode brought to you by
Outtakes.
You know, I was making my coffee this morning and I was like, would Bio Coffee be a sponsor?
We can email and ask.
It wouldn't hurt. So I really appreciated the hospitality he shows to all of the cultures and kind of almost provides a roadmap for approaching that.
And also the way your hospitality is interpreted and felt. And I mean, there were so many throughout the book, but the one that just gripped me so much was in Italy, them spending more money to give them American food because you need to get used to American food because you are not going to be here. And the realization that the bigger teenage kid had, if they are spending more money to make sure we know we are not wanted.
Yeah.
To have any other human being have that realization is awful, but to have a child, and I don't care if he was a teenager, he was a child, have that, man, what are we doing?
And that scene where he's playing soccer, he knows a couple of Italian words, so he's playing soccer, and the old man in the village is like, if any of those gypsy kids come, come tell us, and we'll chase them off. And he's like, he's like, I looked Italian enough. Yeah, it was so, like, heartbreaking.
Man.
So, I want to know, have either of y'all read The Arabian Nights?
No, but I want to. Does that count as my poetry for the year?
Oh,
that's not poetry. It's short stories, right?
Yeah.
But then, you know, he talks about him being poets the whole time. I haven't read it, so I don't know. Yeah. Okay.
I haven't read it yet. It has been on my TBR for a long time as like our next morning time read aloud. So yeah. I am even more excited to do that. And listeners, I would love to hear from you if you've read that. Are there any, like, the way he structured this book, are there any similarities to the way those stories are structured? Like, do the stories weave in and out of one another, or are they separated, or just did anything he was doing remind you of it? And I love how he, so many times in the book, I realized he went back to the number 1,000, even if he's not talking about stories, even just different contexts. And I loved that. And several times he would break the fourth wall and say something like, I am Scheherazade and you are the king. And he would address the reader sometimes as kings or queens of the story or something like that. Loved that.
I did not think of this. It's like actually in the Goodreads blurb. I read this book twice and I did not think of it. But it said that this story, him telling his stories of his life in his classroom, is like Scheherazade telling stories to the king.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
And love it.
I just I hadn't thought of it in that context, but that I did. I do love the quote that I had caught. Every story is the storyteller. Every story is the sound of the storyteller begging to stay alive.
That's what He was so much begging for his classmates to see him as a person. And did y'all, I don't know if I changed my mind about the teacher or if we see growth in her character, but was she not kind of annoyed with him at the beginning of the book? But at the end of the book, we see her like love him and appreciate him. But did I miss it at the beginning of the book or was...
I feel like at the beginning, he kind of paint some things just like, well, Mrs. Miller says I can't do this, or Mrs. Miller says I have to stop telling poop stories.
Yeah.
Or Mrs. Miller, like,
so we don't really
it
know.
It seems like
her.
She's kind of giving him a hard time, but then as the book goes, and I think what you see is even though she may be giving him some of those parameters, and there were ways she was a little uncomfortable, she continues to give him the space to tell the stories. And by the end of the book, he says she was the best teacher I ever had because she kept inviting him to share those stories and giving him that space and that room. And so she kept giving him the floor. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was so beautiful, even though she did not have perfect understanding. She was not the perfect
welcoming whatever. Yeah.
Right. Like she didn't always understand how to handle it, but she kept giving him space.
Which invites us to try. You don't have to be perfect, but you have to try.
Yes.
You have to listen. You have to say, tell me again, because I don't know what in the world you're talking about right now, but tell me again, because it matters.
Yeah.
Did y'all get the 90s nostalgia from this book? It's the 90s, right?
Yeah, he's about our age.
That's what I think, believe, too.
I believe he's 40-ish, something like that.
So I'm looking back and I'm remembering and hearing all these different things, like some of the video games, some of the foods he talks about. I mean, Sloppy Joe's, flute roll-ups, those are the 90s, you know? And I'm also thinking, what would it be like to enter that and not have all those feelings about it, have alien feelings about it? Like, what is this stuff? But I need to write it down because it's important to these people. You know, he would always write down quotes and phrases of things that, like, it matters to y'all. You know, nobody's writing that down about him, though.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love the sports, the way he's like, I got this hat because my friend likes this team. And so we're going to do this together.
Bless him. It was the worst team.
I love how, because you do learn more about, like, you learn more about yourself when you get married. You learn more about yourself when you have children. You learn more about your culture when you see it through the eyes of someone who didn't grow up in it. And when he would say things like, I wanted to wear this hat because it was, I don't remember what he said, but it was something, he gets to the bottom of a thing that I don't always think about because I'm steeped in this culture. But I wore this hat because it meant that we were friends.
Yeah.
Or something like
that. And
that
meant the
world
to him to have a friend.
And to the, we were just talking about Mrs. Miller. I was looking for a quote towards the end of the book from her. And I loved this so much. And I think we're going to be reading quotes all throughout this. I listened to this on audio. Y'all, my system was really bad for this book because I would take a picture on my phone to get the timestamp in the audiobook instead of doing bookmarks because I didn't want to be confused about where my actual bookmarks were. So then at the end, I had 20,000 photos in my photo library. And so I spent a long time going back and had my photos pulled up. And I'd look at the timestamp, go to the audiobook, go to that point. Anyway, I'll stop here. You can cut all this out. Okay, so here's this quote about Miss Miller. Miss Miller says, I have lost the plot and I'm now just making lists of things that happen to fill space. But I replied that she is beholden to a Western mode of storytelling that I do not accept, and that the 1001 nights are basically Scheherazade stalling for time, so I don't see the difference. She laughed when I said this. It was one of those genuine laughs you get, and for a second you see the person they are when they're not a teacher.
Yes.
Like the same laugh she might have had at a movie or something. She said, that was a wonderful use of beholden. And I said, thank you.
She just gave him that smallest reply, but he knew it meant more. That was a wonderful use of beholden. Like, man, yeah, I loved
so sweet.
That part too. And I loved his bravery for all of his almost whipped dog persona that was throughout a lot because of what he'd endured. There was so much strength still in those moments. Like, I'm going to poop on this toilet anyway in the way that I think is right. But also, like, I don't hold to your form of storytelling. I also don't think it's good. You know, that's bravery and resilience. Like only someone who had lived through that much change could have.
Yeah. Does writing poetry make you brave? It's a good question to ask. I think making anything is a brave thing to do. Not like fighting brave, obviously, but a kind that looks at a horrible situation and doesn't crumble. Making anything assumes there's a world worth making it for.
I wrote that one too.
It's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Reading is the act of listening and speaking at the same time with someone you've never met, but love. Even if you hate them, it's a loving thing to do. You speak someone else's words to yourself and hear them for the first time.
I mean, we all have boys here. How about how he talked about his mom? I'm sitting here looking at the legend of my mom is that she cannot be stopped. Not when you hit her, not when the whole country full of goons puts her in a cage, not even if you make her poor and try to kill her slowly in a little by little poison of sadness. And the legend is true. I think because she's fixed her eyes on something beyond the rivers of blood to a beautiful place on the other side, how else would anyone do it? Like, that's a story of faith, too, because we know what she had fixed her eyes on. But also that we worry so much that the things we're doing our children don't see. And so often they don't. But he saw. He saw what his mom was doing. It wasn't my mom's never around. It was, well, my mom is saving the day every day.
Yeah.
I, in my place of one boy who is mostly raised and one who is just in the starting to give me feedback era of getting parented, I was in tears every time. Because it wasn't just one time. It wasn't just that one. But he continually talked about how brave and strong and smart and driven and unstoppable his mom was.
Well, yeah. He says she's the hero of the story.
It could have so easily been, my mom ruined it all when she took us away, though. And he didn't. He didn't see it that way.
Yeah. For 40 days, my mom sat in the chair of 8 hours each day and never stopped erasing.
Erasing!
If you look at her hands, you can still see the bumps where it bled so much. I'm telling you, unstoppable. My mom is the unstoppable force.
Nate was mad about erasing a mistake on a paper the other day. And I told him about that. And I told him, I'm so glad that you have a pile of erasers and you only have one line to erase. And I know this is hard right now, but read this, listen to this. And you know, it probably was one of those roll your eyes, mom is just being really dramatic moments, but it was like, I need you to know, like, people's quest for education is so strong. Like, you are so lucky. It was probably just out of his grasp at that moment, but I was like, listen, it's one line. But also, I mean, obviously he couldn't understand, but...
Another quote about his mom. The legend of my mother is that she does not stop. And if you don't stop, you are unstoppable.
Yes.
So simple. It's right there. So meaty. And there's another one.
That in the story he tells about the way she would come home from work
and
just not stop and just immediately go make them food. And what that meant to him, like that he knew that she had been working all day. But the second she came, he's like, she didn't even stop to take her shoes off. Like, she just straight to the kitchen to make us good food. They were going to have one good meal. And I was just like, oh, that is love. That is love.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, here's another one about his mom. What is the toughest stuff on earth, you'd say? Diamonds. But you'd be wrong. You should have said your mom. And if I said, what is toughness anyway? Is it being an unbreakable rock? You'd say, yes, because you'd be thinking of it wrong. And I'd say, but isn't it harder to break water? And you'd say, well, yes, you can't break water. I would try not to smirk here because Mrs. Miller says that's why I don't have any friends. And you'd say, but at the molecular level, everything is eventually breakable, even an atom. And you'd be right, because being breakable has nothing to do with toughness. Everything breaks.
Everything is whirling around in a big bunch of motion and energy, crashing into each other at the size of atoms and icebergs, and will crumble eventually. But then you'd say, so what makes you think your mom is so tough? And I would say this part slowly because I've said it before. I'd probably even whisper, because she's unstoppable. Every rock smashes into everything else and breaks. That doesn't matter. What matters is whether the rock keeps going the same direction it was going when it smashed. Do you see what I mean? It keeps going.
Amazing.
So I think that there is a thread that showed up through this book to me of the validation kids get from their parents.
Oh.
Even though she was not showing up at school, and there was a gap in his validation at school because there were no seen parents. Like the second his dad shows up, oh, everything was true. Everything was amazing. Tell us some more. But like it hadn't been happening, but he still carried the validation of his mom because of who she believed she was. That's what made him go tell his tales each day. Is that he was carrying what he knew to be true in him, and she was reinforcing that daily by making those dinners and the way she talked to him. I still don't really understand the Ray portion of the story, to be honest.
What do you mean?
But, well, the mom and the stepdad, you know, like, it doesn't really come about how they got together. I really wanted to kind of know what happened there. But that's fine. He didn't choose to share that. I think what shows that was not important to him. But she each day was reinforcing who he was and who they were going to be as a family. And I think we just can't, as parents, sell that as important enough, that the validation that we provide for our kids, and that's, you got to work to do that.
Yeah, for sure.
I've got one more about his mom. My mom is the hero of this whole story, in case you were wondering. She always did what heroes do. The law that applied to her was the law of sacrificial love. The legend was unstoppable belief. The myth was the strongest person you have ever known. Not Hercules, not Rostam, not Jean-Claude Van Damme could protect and love as Seema, my mom, who was our champion, and who, like Jesus, took all the damage so we wouldn't have to. Ugh! And this reminds me of when he's talking about hearing his parents fighting. I gotta find that one. Oh, here it is. The only protection, I don't know, maybe I should start sooner. You're a little ball of soft meat with no shell or escape skills or battle strategies. You're a milk drinker with milk teeth that fall out and you bleed. The only protection is those two distracted grown-ups fighting and scratching at each other. It's like looking up and seeing the material of your parachute fray and flutter. And you think, I'm going to die. They're going to split apart, and I will free fall into brambles where the demons hide, into their waiting claws. The whole world will tear me open. Like you were saying, Elizabeth, the role of the parent.
I feel like if someone is listening to this episode and they haven't read the book, you might get the impression that they're like, this book is just full of kind of philosophical statements, or, you know, because it has all these little gems in it, but it really is just
a story,
a collection of stories. Mm-hmm. Like it's just a great story that is told in a way that kind of jumps around in anecdotes. It starts out with stories of his family, his ancestors. So you get a picture of where he's from and some things his family went through and their culture. And then you start getting this story of the way they had to immigrate to America and what their life was like in Oklahoma. And it's just the most precious, precious story.
If you listen, I'll tell you a story. We can know and be known together, and then we're not enemies anymore. Like, I'm going to print that and put it on my refrigerator. Like,
yes.
That almost sounds like it could be Winnie the Pooh.
Yeah.
You know, I love that so much.
Yeah.
He just handles language so well to tell his story. You know, he's wielding it. I mean,
yeah, for sure.
And jumping off the quote you just shared, Elizabeth, here's another one. The point of the nights is that if you spend time with each other, if we really listen in the parlors of our minds and look at each other as we were meant to be seen, then we would fall in love. We would marvel at how beautifully we were made. We would never think to be villain kings, and we would never kill each other. Just the opposite. The stories aren't the thing. The thing is the story of the story, the spending of the time, the falling in love. All the good stuff is in between and around the things that happen.
Oh, that's so good.
Yeah.
And didn't you learn so much about Persian culture? Like, that was the other thing, too. Yeah. Is I just loved how much he wove that culture and background. And, I mean, from the very beginning, I mean, is this not one of the best openings to a book ever?
All Persians are...
I have it here. All Persians are liars, and lying is a sin. That's what the kids in Mrs. Miller's class think. But I'm the only Persian they've ever met, so I don't know where they got that idea. My mom says it's true, but only because everyone has sinned and needs God to save them. My dad says it isn't. Persians aren't liars. They're poets, which is worse. Poets don't even know they're lying. They're just trying to remember their dreams. They're trying to remember 6,000 years of history and all the versions of all the stories ever told.
6,000 years of history is something that we cannot understand. And he touches on that, like... that one house or building was old and they had to go into it. And he was like, well, my granddad's house was 400 years old. Like, what are you talking about?
No, I love that. They were like, this house is 98 years old and it's a museum. And he was so confused.
Like, why is it a museum?
He's like, is this what you do here? You just, like, is 98 a magic number? It becomes a museum. Like, he was like, I don't understand.
Yeah. Well, and he made that the cultural outtakes that you're continually learning, these tidbits of Persian culture, he made them so funny as only someone talking about their own culture can do. Like, you can't observe someone else's culture and tell it in a way like that. Because what was the word? Tariff, which is the out politeness when you over polite back and forth.
Tariff.
It, yep. I mean, that sounds like Southern people. And I was dying. Like, I get it. I know what you're talking about. It is exhausting. But also, and then, you know, he was just like outright offended over just the silliest, smallest thing with the mechanic story. And I was just loving it. But I don't think I could have seen that interaction, even though I felt like that resonated with me. I don't think I could have seen that interaction and thought it was as funny as the way he was telling it about his culture. Like, well, this is such a Persian thing.
I had a friend in high school who's Persian, and she's from Iran, and I referred to her as Iranian, and she said, no, we're not Iranian. We are Persian.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not understand the difference till I met her and got to learn about that a little bit. But I love that identity, that cultural identity is different from the national.
Yeah. Cultures are older than country boundaries.
Yeah. Right. And these current boundaries were drawn by the winners of World War I.
Right.
So they drew these boundaries in the Middle East, which he refers to when he talked about the group that was not Shiite or Sunni.
In the middle.
Yes. Like the wandering culture.
Yeah.
The nomads.
And I'm blank on that right
now.
Yeah,
I don't remember
but I
what
know
it was
that.
Called. Yeah.
But I love how he explained the difference between the Shiite and the Sunni. That was the clearest, easiest to understand explanation I've heard.
Yes,
it was really,
it really
helpful.
Was.
And the 6,000 years of history and the thread in the story talking about how there's different versions of myths. And then all the talk of myth and legend and tales and truth and what's the difference. And they're all mixed together with the truth and the different versions. And again, that there's layers of that in his own stories that he's telling his friends. Ah, man. It's just so great.
Yeah, on that memory, because he's telling all these tales that, they get shifted. But he says, memories are tricky things. They can fade or fester. You have to seal them up tight like pickles and keep out impurities, like how hurt you feel when you open them, or they'll ferment and poison your brain. And imagine each generation telling tales and passing them down that are possibly fermenting their brain, possibly have been preserved. And he's telling 6,000 years of that as a kid. I mean,
amazing.
This makes me sad because I feel like when a culture stops telling their stories or they reject their own stories, they lose their memory.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't be a whole person, you can't be a whole healthy culture if you've lost your memory. And I love how he said, his dad, when he was speaking in his class, he said, "Kosru, tell them this. They don't understand what stories are for." "What are they for?" I said. "For remembering," he said. And that just made me think about what we talk about on this podcast and why I read, why I want to read the great books in particular, and why I love to talk about them, because I'm remembering things I didn't even know I had forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
And things that education has forgotten, that leadership has forgotten, and our culture has forgotten. And like the deep magic, as C.S. Lewis talks about, the knowable things, the myths. And this is what The Great Conversation is all about. I just found his book very inspiring in that way.
So did you find this to be a sad book?
Yes, but it's not in the end. It's not on the whole. The themes are not, but the individual moments did feel like a lot of sadness to me. But I think when you hold it at the end, this is not a sad book. This is a hope book. This is redemption. This is, where are you going? I know where I'm going, you know, but the road there is hard. But the individual stories often made me really sad. Just sad that a kid felt that, probably, mostly, is it?
Yeah.
I completely agree. This is not a sad book. Just like a life is woven with all the ordinary parts in between, referring to a quote I just read a few minutes ago, that's mostly what a life is made up of. And then there's really sad times, and then there's maybe an even fewer number of just the brightest spots that you always remember that were just the best times. And so just like a life is a tapestry of that, this book is. And so I feel like it's a celebration of his life and all the parts of it.
And when you look back at your sad memories, they are just as special as the big celebratory days. I mean, I know that I can't look back on 2016 and think what a bad year that was. That is the year we had Everett in our home. Like, mm-hmm. I got that in the end of him telling this story. Like, every hard story I told you is my beautiful life that got me here. And I'm so glad it happened. And so those sad memories are exactly perfectly wonderful next to your happiest memory when you're looking back on them and when you're saying, this is the sum of me.
This harkens to the title, Everything Sad is Untrue. And as I was reading, I had in my mind, I want to partly read this book to understand this title. And then I listened, before I was done with the book, I watched an interview with the author on YouTube. And I wrote down what he said because they asked him about the title. Do you want me to read what he said about the title?
Yeah.
He said he got it from Lord of the Rings. Of course, he mentions The Hobbit, and in another interview, he said that is his favorite book. But he said it's in the saddest moment when Gandalf dies and Sam, who is the heart of the whole story, is despondent. In the darkness, they hear the sound of laughter and see that Gandalf has come back as Gandalf the White. Sam runs to him and asks a naive question. "Now that you're back, is everything sad going to become untrue?" The sad fact being that he was dead, is now an untrue fact. So is everything else going to be like that? Are all the problems going to be fixed? And then Daniel goes on to say, on a long enough timeline, the answer is yes. The curse, sin, the brokenness, everything will be fixed. Gandalf is Jesus in the story, and his death does undo the sad, ultimately.
Ugh.
That was me semi-quoting him and a couple of my thoughts mixed in, but that's mostly him.
Yeah, he just mentioned that briefly so in the story, beautiful. And I had a note to go back and look up because I have not read Lord of the Rings yet, to go, okay, what was this? Because he briefly said something about that was a reference, and I forgot to look it up. I'm glad you brought that.
I did not realize how Christian this book was when I picked it up. Oh my word, there are so many beautiful quotes about that. And Oh, the thread of a God who listens versus a God who, speaks. And even he throws in a God who devours once or twice.
Yeah.
Oh, and he applies that to Ms. Miller. He applies that to his mom. And I'm like, oh my goodness, I want to be a mother who listens and speaks, not one or the other, and not one who devours, you know. Mm-hmm. Oh, but the theology in this book is just amazing.
And I, through the beginning, I was wondering, is this his mom's theology? Is this his mom's faith? And it shows, you know, towards around the middle, I start to get like, nope, I think it's his. No, I think it's his too. Even though he's seeing imperfect versions of it with the youth pastor who was probably trying and it just went really badly. And then he just was like, I don't know what to do here. And Ray, who's awful. And,
oh my word.
Right. But he's seeing imperfect versions of it, but that doesn't confuse him about what is true and who God is. And that Jesus, in fact, came and did what he said.
Yeah.
And there's a thread about miracles in here. He says, miracles are absurd by definition. I love that so much. If they weren't, they'd just be odd things that happened, improbable things. But while miracles are impossible, they aren't coincidences. They're knives that cut into our reality, and they're messy and weird.
Messy and weird.
I think this quote, to me, sums up the whole thing, because you were talking about whether it's his faith or her faith, and the way I see that all playing out is in the hope. It's like you said, Elizabeth, this is a book about hope and about what we're looking toward. And that in the end, on a long enough timeline, everything sad is untrue. And to me, that is the heart of faith. That is the heart of faith, is that in the end, everything will be redeemed. And there's this book that has all of this sad in it. There is a lot of sad. Like, you know, listeners that posted in the group, and I'm having a hard time with this book. There's just so much sad. And there is. But Elizabeth, like you said, isn't that every one of our lives? We live in a broken world, in a fallen world, in a divided world. And there is so much sad, so much sickness, so much misunderstanding, so much pain. But toward the end of the book, this is what he says. I don't know how my mom was so unstoppable despite all that stuff happening. I don't know. Maybe it's anticipation, hope, the anticipation that the God who listens in love will one day speak justice. The hope that some final fantasy will come to pass that will make everything sad untrue, unpainful. That across rivers of sewage and blood will be a field of yellow flowers blooming. You can get lost there and still be unafraid. No one will chase you off of it. It's yours. A father who loves you planted it for you. A mother who loves you watered it. And maybe there are other people there, but they are all kind. Or better than that, they are right with each other. They treat each other right. If you have that, maybe you keep moving forward.
Masterpiece.
I mean, the way everything that's woven into that little piece, the yellow flowers go way back to the beginning of the book and his ancestors and the saffron fields. And, you know, we laugh about the poop stories.
But the sewage river.
Right. Mm-hmm. The rivers of sewage and blood. Like that is the hard part of our life. But across rivers of sewage and blood will be a field of yellow flowers blooming. Like that is what we're going for. That is why we get up and keep going every morning. And this book, if you got stuck in the middle of this book because it was so sad, please, please keep going.
Oh, yeah.
To get to the end so you can read that paragraph and know what it means. And this is why I started a commonplace book this year. And this is why I'm so glad I'm doing it. Because like you, Amanda, I spent an hour going through my bookmarks in my audiobook so that I could write down all these quotes. I have like 22 of them. And these I printed because it was so much. I was like, I don't want to rewrite them now that I spent an hour typing them. But they are going to be in my commonplace book forever. And when I get discouraged, I am going to pull out this quote. And I'm going to remember this story. And it is going to become one of my guiding lights. And that is why we read. It is why we read.
Yeah, I think this is one I need on my shelf, and I needed to read it again on paper.
With it all highlighted up.
Just to commonplace the thing. I'm going to commonplace the poop out of it.
I was waiting for that just now.
Oh my.
And you know, it might even be fun. This is probably untenable. But for all of these threads to have a different color and to highlight them in their color to see when they pop up and how. I don't know. The craft in this book, the craft of writing, the philosophy, the theology, the heart, the warmth of this book. I don't know. This is probably going to be one of the best books I read all year.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Speaking of old culture moving to young culture, I thought this was really funny on the food conversation. At church potlucks, they play a secret game of dumping random cans of food in casserole dishes and pretending their grandmothers gave them the recipe. Jell-O is their favorite. Campbell's mushroom Jell-O goes on everything. Campbell's mushroom Jell-O goes on everything. So does Velveeta, which is cheese Jell-O that only sort of hardens. If that is not the story of 90s church potlucks.
Oh my word.
And they play a game and pretend their grandmother gave them the recipe. I mean, to see a 10-year-old walk into our culture and be like, this is cute that y'all think you have like an old civilization. That's cool. That's all right. I'll play along. Give me some barbecue sauce. And isn't that something to check our arrogance here and there? You know,
yes.
A 10-year-old walks into a church potluck and was like, well, this is sweet.
Like, bless their heart.
Bless your heart, Oklahoma. I mean, it was a funny line, but it said so much to me. If he's just like, so we're doing it. Okay.
All right. So I'm dying to know with this book, what discussion do you want to have on the Facebook page?
That's a great question.
I think this would not be a good Facebook thing. Just because it will be lengthy. But I would love for people to think through with themselves. Or if you have a friend that listens to this also and y'all are chatting over coffee, I'd love for you to talk about the ways that you have shored up and encouraged your children or your family during hard seasons. Because that's what the mom did. But I don't know how.
I think we could have a separate talk for
Facebook.
Yeah, but we could have a separate post where we ask that question and let people share the nuggets of ideas. I think that's beautiful.
That's a great question. I mean, just share your favorite quotes. I have another one. You don't get to choose what you remember.
Mm-hmm.
Man, there's so much in that sentence.
Yeah.
It's kind of sad, but it's true. And well, that's okay. It's okay that it's sad.
How important it was for him to share what he remembered, because at the end of the book, his mom's like, well, that's not what happened. That wasn't your fault. And he'd been carrying it, you know? So that's why living in our communities actively and telling, you know, Amanda, you talk about the furniture of our mind. And so he kind of said similar too. And so sharing that space, though, with those close to us might really free us for something that we are not supposed to be carrying.
I would love to know what nuggets are you taking away from this book? Did you think it was worth, was the sad journey worth the ending of Everything Sad is Untrue? And what are you taking away from it?
So listeners, as I said at the beginning, we have a private Facebook group. Search for Book Fair Podcast. We do a post for every episode. So we would love to hear your thoughts in that post. This was really just a celebration of this book. There was no analysis. There's no like high literary discussion here. Just awe and wonder about this book. So we would love to hear your favorite quotes, threads or themes that stood out to you, like Tricia said, was a sad journey worth the ending? What are you taking from it? And I didn't get down what you said, Elizabeth, but we can do another post about that as well.
I love it. And keep throwing out these wonderful books that you want us to read together. I am so glad we did this book together.
I feel like I need to say thank
you. And side note, yes, thank you. Yeah,
yes.
And side note, Close Reads is also doing this book this year. So if you want some actual literary analysis from actual literary experts, you can listen to those episodes.
We should do a post in our group for people that listen to that after having read it and walking through this reading with us.
Yeah, that would be super
fun. And we could talk about what we learned from them in a post also.
And until next time, I'm Trisha.
I'm Amanda.
I'm Elizabeth.
And happy reading.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this, subscribe to Book Fair Podcast.
Join our private Facebook group. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram, or email us at chat@bookfairpodcast.com.
And you can help us continue to grow. Share an episode with a friend, mention us on social media, and leave a review in your podcast app. We'll see you next Tuesday.